Hey, oh, welcome to another episode of Adventures in the Creative Industries. I don't know why I'm talking so fast, so loud today, but I am feeling it. Cue the music! My name is Eric Ravaglia and I am the host, creator and producer of this podcast. I'm basically your one-man band. Thank you very much for tuning in. On the sofa with me is Dave Cook. Dave is a comic book writer, former video game journalist, author, and PR consultant in Edinburgh. In 2014, he founded an independent comic production house called Card Shark Comics, under which he published a number of comic book series, culminating with Killtopia in 2018. Killtopia is a successful Kickstarter and won the Creative Edinburgh Award for Creativity. You should know the trick by now. In the next hour or so, we'll go through the motions of Dave's career and personal life. We'll touch on his video game journalist days. We'll also discuss his path to becoming a comic book writer and what it takes to create a successful Kickstarter campaign. 3, 2, 1, go! Dave, hello, sir.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Welcome. You guys are rock and rolling right now. Killtopia is, can we call it a success?
Yeah, it's, well, I guess, and it's still strange to think of it this way, but it's an award-winning comic now, which is like, blows my mind. But yeah.
That's pretty good. Like, the fact is, right, this has taken about 10 years, would you say, to get here?
Round about 10 years, yeah, since the ideas to do comics started, yeah. Yeah, yeah, about that.
Because I remember you were touching on briefly on one of your talks, Creative Points, shout out to the Creative Points team. What I liked is the sheer determination to get this shit done. It's amazing. Like, I realized, you know, you guys have a successful Kickstarter, which is in itself an achievement, and I've seen why it was successful. We'll talk about it, because there's some elements in terms of marketing and communication that I think is important to drill into people they want to do a Kickstarter. And I read the comic, I really liked it. It really got me. Very nice storytelling tricks you got there. I liked it. I thought, I was like, oh god, I need to read number two. When is number two coming out?
The Kickstarter will be on March the 1st, and that's like the first time we've revealed that. So there's a little exclusive, I guess.
Yeah. Yay!
We're looking at a September October launch again. So I think we'll just keep that kind of cadence moving forward, I think. But yeah, we'll see how the Kickstarter goes first.
So you guys are going yearly with this?
Yeah, I mean, ideally we'd like to go sooner, but you know, Craig and I have like our own projects and we both do freelance and contracts and stuff. So it's just trying to find a work rate that doesn't make us go crazy.
Excuses. All excuses. my question is, right, why? Why did you decide to get into writing comic books?
Yeah, it's one I can kind of trace back to quite an unlikely place, I think, which is I've always been a big video game fan, like since I was like, really young. I think maybe like age 7, I got my first video game console, which was the Spectrum, which in my opinion is better than the Commodore 64.
People
can fight me over that if they want.
We are starting this podcast on the wrong foot, my friend. I was a Commodore 64 dude.
Oh,
I was sitting there by the cassette loading, you know?
Yeah.
Like that feeling of, is this going to load?
Mm-hmm.
Is this going to play?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't know about that. Fair enough.
I may be fanning flames a little bit. But so I was a big video game fan, right?
Yeah.
And I, when I was really young, started to think about, oh, I'd like to write my own game one day. I'd like to design something like for the Mega Drive or the SNES as a career. But then I, you know, writing the storylines for these fake games that I was just making up on bits of paper, realized I liked writing. So I got into English at high school, started freelancing for free for a punk magazine, like a fanzine down south, which is my first ever writing gig.
What year are we talking here?
Oh, so probably right after graduation from high school, which would have been about, I always forget when I actually graduated. I think like the year 2000 or 2001.
Oh,
right about that time, so quite a while ago now.
Okay.
So I would get like through the mail a big package bubble wrap package of demo CDs and like EPs and stuff from like unknown punk bands to review, which was a free gig. But hey, you know, I got like free CDs. It was kind of cool. That then led to, but then I thought like, you know, I still love video games then. Like I was working in video game shops, you know, like Game and Game Station. Rest in peace to Game Station.
I remember Game Station. So I've been in the UK long enough that I have seen a Game Station. I have been in a Game Station. I don't know if I ever purchased anything from a Game Station. Maybe a keychain. But tell me about that experience, man.
Yeah, it was cool, man. Like, because you got to borrow the games for free for like a week or something at a time. So it was kind of like, hey, like...
That's a great perk.
Yeah, and you could borrow them before they came out because they got delivered to the shop like a while in advance. So like you got to like play games before they came out and it was kind of cool. And,
that is amazing.
Yeah, man.
That explains the rumors on Reddit and everything.
Like why, you know, why games leak and stuff, you know, yeah. These people will take them and... pirate them and stuff anyway, but it was cool. But you got a lot of complaints from people who claimed their consoles weren't working, and then you say, have you set it up using the instruction manual or what? And you're like, well, you know,
and what console are we talking about? Is that the Wii,
the original Wii,
and the Xbox, I guess.
The original Wii was the worst because you had to sync up the controllers with the Bluetooth, the wireless and stuff. Oh, this controller doesn't work. I'm like, have you synced it to the console, sir? No. I'm like, well, you know.
That's why.
But then they'd be like, I still want a refund. It's still broken. So that was fun. it was
working
cool,
with
man.
The public.
It was cool. Because like, especially when people traded in retro games, which I'm a big retro game collector.
Yes. Because you guys used to sell Mega Drive, Super Nintendo cartridges, Game Boy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you got first dibs on it. So something super rare would come in. And you'd be like, I'm just going to put that aside and buy that after my shift.
Do you know what? It's so cool. I always thought about that. I was like, man, it would be so cool to work in one of those places. You'll get first dib every time. And then I was like, yeah, but what I do is a bit better. So I think I can just buy it. It's fine. I just pay full price. Cheers.
Yeah. We also got free copies of the magazines, right? So Edge, Games TM and stuff. And I got really into reading those.
Really?
We got, because we had to know, like we had to research and be clued up about the new games that were coming out, right? So they let us, there was like a copy in the canteen we could read and stuff like that. Then I was like, I would love to write video game reviews. I'm kind of bored with writing the punk reviews and the music reviews. I want to do video game stuff. So a friend of mine basically said, hey, I'm writing the games section for The Skinny. Would you like to chip in and help me out, do a few reviews here and there? And I was like, yeah, cool. So I started doing that for free, but I was getting free games now. I was getting free review copies of games. And I'm like, this is so cool. We all started doing this section in The Skinny. It was getting really popular. And we thought, do you know what? We could probably branch out and do our own little magazine. And we did for 5 issues. And not a lot of people know this, but it was called Square Go. Right. We did 5 print issues of this little magazine, a select group of us. Like we're all still friends now. It's kind of like this underground little zine that we made. And Game Station on Princess Street stocked it for a while, which is so cool.
So that means that, what year is this?
Oh, okay. Now we're talking like 2004 or 5, like around about that kind of time.
That's so cool. So people actually saw that magazine thinking, the fuck is this? But like they actually saw the magazine in the shop.
Cool. And around about this time, I was tenaciously like pitching the idea of a games column to The Scotsman, because I'm like, we make Grand Theft Auto in this country. We make loads of other cool games in this country, but no one's shouting about it. Please let me do a column. No, no, no. One time I phoned up and said, hey, it's me again. And they were getting really annoyed at this point. And they were like, funnily enough, our tech guy just quit a few weeks ago. So we'll give it a shot. So I ended up with a column in the Saturday magazine in The Scotsman. So every Saturday, and that ran for about 5 years. I won 3 industry awards off the back of it for it was best newspaper columnist in the UK. So I won 3 like industry awards off of it. I got all the free games and consoles I wanted.
What the hell is this?
It was
cool.
This
is amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
This is like 12 years old me is like just salivating right now. It's like, this is the dream job.
Yeah, and I was getting paid for that Scotsman column. It wasn't great because it was like like 80 to 150 words a column. So it was cool. It was getting, you know, if you work for a national newspaper in a gaming capacity, you get all the free stuff because everyone wants like to help you out. And
did you go to the E3 then?
I've been to E3, yeah.
God.
But then like I thought, do you know what? This is a little side gig. The fanzine's doing well. I'm freelancing for The List here and there. I'm doing little things for them as well. But I thought, do you know, I want to actually be a games journalist now. This is it. I'm convinced. This is what I want to do.
How did you go from wanting to do a magazine? And that's hilarious in itself, because like that was a time, instead of starting a website, you started a magazine, which is great. So like, how did you go with this group of people say, do you know what? Screw it. We're going to do our own magazine.
We were meeting up quite regularly in the Meadows Bar, just to catch up, and we were kind of like a little team writing for The Skinny, and we just decided, you know, we could do this ourselves, because The Skinny section was always like under the threat of getting cancelled at some point. They weren't sure if it was like what people really wanted from The Skinny, so we thought, you know, we can make our own little thing here. And it was headed up by a guy called Josh, who I've not seen for a very long time actually, but he, you know, he was interested in making it a magazine. He was speaking with advertisers about taking out like print ads, and yeah, it sustained us like for like 5 issues. It was
That's
really fun.
Very entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
Like you were like, what, in your 20s, early 20s?
Early 20s. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds like, is it not what a 20-year-old, you know, would think to do, is like to say, to go on and make a magazine. So that feels like a little bit like my origin story there, you know. That was the bite of the spider, you know. That's the moment, right? Would you say that was the moment?
I think so, yeah. Because I was, when I started thinking like I could make a proper career out of being a games journalist, and I thought, you know, I've got the itch, I'm going to try this. So basically I was pitching for freelance work at the big publishers down south. So in Bournemouth, you've got like Imagine Publishing. In Bath, you've got Future, who do like Edge, stuff like that. So, but because I was in Scotland, you know, all the press events are in London. If you're not in London, it's kind of a hard sell.
That's it, exactly.
Yeah. But then, however, one day they were rejecting me a lot. But one day they went, hey, there's a game up in Dundee that there's a press event for. And we don't really want to send someone up north, so would you like to do it?
What
and
was
it was
the
for
game?
Crackdown 2, made by Ruffian Games. So I was like, sure, I'll do it. And that was my first commission. Then a job listing came up at Imagine, and I got it. So I had to tell my wife, hey, we're moving down to the south coast of England in a month. she knew about it, though. It wasn't a massive surprise, but I think it just hit us like, oh, this is happening now.
This is real.
Yeah, so that was 2010. We moved down to Bournemouth. I started my career as a games journalist, and did it as a full-time job. It was crazy. Super low paying, but the perks were great. So going to E3, going to Gamescom, going all over the world to press events, and never once paying for a video game or console for like the best part of like a decade, which was really cool. And then eventually got a job remote working. We were a bit miserable in Bournemouth because there's not really much to do there. It's not the best place, but
that's interesting.
Yeah,
there was a time in my life I was so close to move to Bournemouth because the best animation course is down there, and I was very close to move down to Bournemouth.
Oh wow, yeah, it's a big uni town. Lots of, well, put it this way, every single bar and club is open till 5 a.m. every night of the week.
That's crazy.
Mad party town. Wow. Mad. It's expensive to live there, but being a games journalist, it doesn't pay that much because the perks are good. It's one of those kind of jobs, right, where it's like, hey, you know, if you don't want this job, someone else is right behind you.
Who will take it? There'll be a list of 100, at least, kids behind you that will die to do this job.
Yeah, so. And you know, like, that's when I first got a taste for, like, you know, big, longer form journalism, so writing like more story like stuff. So stuff that set a scene, stuff that really got into the meat of like what studios were all about, the people behind the games. But then I got a job remote working for another website. I left Imagine Publishing and started working for VG247, who's like a breaking news website kind of thing.
Yeah, that's all news, isn't it? It'll be news. All right.
And that was cool. But because it was remote, my boss just said, hey, I know you aren't happy. You and your wife aren't happy in Bournemouth. Would you like to move home? You've got my blessing to move home and take the job with you. So we did.
That's amazing, though.
Yeah, it was really nice. Like,
yeah.
Properly nice, yeah. But then after a while, I was like, because it's breaking news, these articles are going out, and in 24 hours, no one cares about them. And I said, I want to make something that lasts. And I was like, I know, I'll write a novel. And
that was?
It was called Seventh Circle, and it's about the afterlife. I'm not going to go too much into it because I'm embarrassed by it. Wasn't very good.
So that was project number one then?
Project number one. What I found though, I wasn't very good at writing descriptive prose. You know, like the guy was wearing this, the room looked like that. I was really bad at setting a scene. So I thought, what if I got an artist to draw that stuff for me? Hey, I know, I'm going to make a comic. And that was the moment I was like, cool, there we go, I'm going to do a comic. Didn't know how to do that. I had no like knowledge of what it took to make a comic. But, you know, you just go on Google, you search, you know, template comic script. How do you do a comic? How do you find artists? And all the information's there. And through a few contacts, I got like my first, they call them future shocks, like little short 5-page stories that have a little twist at the end, so really punchy, succinct. And it was about a killer teddy bear that killed its owner because it was his owner was all grown up and didn't play with him anymore. So she so the teddy bear frames his owner for murder, okay, just to get her out of the picture and pay for payback. And that was like a little one-off, just to see if I fancied it, you know, as something I wanted to pursue. It went well and people were like, hey, you know, are you doing anything else? It'd be cool to see like other ideas. And I thought, right, I'm doing this. And that's how it started, really.
Wow. Okay.
Very roundabout trajectory. But
it started with like video games, lots of video game writing, to writing a 5-page comic.
Yep.
And then off to the races.
That's it.
Yep. So how do you take it from there?
Well, I thought I want to make a full scale issue, like a full book, and I only intended ever doing one comic and then just to say I'd done it, right? I had no idea to make a studio. I didn't really think beyond that. I didn't even think about Kickstarter. Although when I was a games journalist, I'd interviewed a lot of developers who had used Kickstarter. A lot of them had failed, a lot of them had succeeded, but I got like through those interviews a feel for how to do them, how to set them up, how to price it, how to market it. They were really cool at telling me, like, here's how we did it. So I was learning from people who had failed on the platform, people who had done really well.
So out of these people, who did you meet? Like, what was the most successful and the least successful?
So probably the most successful at the time was Tim Schafer from Double Fine.
Of course, yeah.
Who did, I forget what the game's called now, Broken something. It'll come to me later. So it was a point and click game.
Yes.
And I think at the time, his was the most profitable Kickstarter ever, 3.5 million or something like that.
It wasn't, I remember they got a lot of press for it.
Yeah.
And it was probably the first real example that you could make a good amount of money, or you could raise a good amount of money for a project through Kickstarter. I remember it was like, oh, okay, so this is a thing now.
Yeah.
And like, it's amazing how many very good video games we got out of it. Because like, if you think about it,
yeah,
Shovel Knight, fantastic game. Mm-hmm. Kickstarter. Hollow Knight, beautiful game,
so good.
Kickstarter, it's like,
I actually sent them an email,
did you,
2 months ago, saying, hey, you ever thought about doing a comic prequel to Hollow Knight? I'll make it for you.
And please tell me
they never replied.
No.
I'm sure there's like licensing and all these, they've got a publisher probably now and stuff, but
it would make sense. Yeah,
yeah. But I thought, but that kind of sums up why, because you mentioned earlier, like, why did I do a print magazine over online? Because we, that collective and myself, we just try stuff. We just do things and things happen. I think someone asked me, like, you know, how do you find time for all this? How do you figure out that you wanted to do all this? I'm like, I just like do things. I'm like the Joker in The Dark Knight. I just do things so things happen.
Chaos.
Yeah, I try things though. That's the thing. I mean, I've done a lot of stuff that's failed, right? Like the novel.
Yeah.
But from that novel, that process, I learned what I could do and how I could maybe adapt it. And I just think, you know, if you're hesitant to try, you'll never figure out what you want to do. Like that, I firmly believe that.
Oh, that's my mantra. That's why we're in this room right now. But like, tell me more about a novel.
You really want to know about the novel. Okay.
For a start, tell me about the process of deciding to writing a novel.
Okay, so I had an idea. It sort of came from, there's a video game series called Persona, where Japanese school kids have these like pistols that they use to shoot themselves in the head. Not really shooting themselves in the head, but they put it up to their head, pull the trigger, and they're transported to this like world of demons and this more fantastical kind of version of reality. So they're hopping between reality and this crazy dimension. And I thought,
just as a side note, the game is absolute bananas. Yeah. He's done his best to try and describe it. That's pretty.
It's hard to quantify.
It's very hard to quantify Persona. Yeah.
And I thought, what if I thought that's a cool setup for like an afterlife story? So what if people like, so the whole thing's about suicide. Three people in a really bad place in their lives, each with their own backstories that you don't quite know about. They're in a dark place and you feel sorry for them, but actually they've all done something really bad to deserve where they are. So it's New Year's Eve. They all decide to shoot themselves in the head. But rather than dying, they end up in the seventh circle of hell, which is, from Dante's Inferno, is where people who commit suicide go.
Not the video game, the actual book.
No, good game though.
Play on Xbox 360.
But in this instance, the seventh circle of hell is like a ghetto. It's a big urban metropolis where some people get a second chance to redeem themselves. So they live in this city. They're basically immortal, and they're going to live there forever until they earn the right to either go to heaven or go to hell. So it's like a second filter to decide where people go after they die. But the humans in this place are like, who gets to decide our fate? So it's almost like a rebellion against like this whole system of the afterlife and all that kind of thing. So it was kind of a bit noir, a bit like Sin City, and it wasn't written very well.
Why was it not written very well?
I just never had done that kind of narrative before. But, dialogue and stuff. Like it didn't feel that natural. I think if you were to read it out loud, it felt like a script rather than people talking. Mm-hmm. The descriptive stuff wasn't that great. The pacing was probably all over the map. And I finished it though. Like it's actually finished and it's a big book. So
how many words are talking?
Tens of thousands. Like a proper big book.
Did you hit the 100,000 mark for sci-fi?
I did actually. Yeah, tens of thousands isn't that much, I've just realized. No. It was in the hundreds of thousands, sorry. It must have been because it was like 18 chapters long and they were big and it was just like
meaty book.
Too big. And I hadn't then understood the virtue of being punchy and succinct, which is a big thing, especially in comics, when you've only got so many panels on a page, you need to keep the pace going and you need to like make sure everything that happens is to the service of the plot. Whereas that book just wasn't. There was a lot of meandering and side stuff that didn't really matter. And
That's what I love comics in terms of storytelling. Every page matters.
Yeah.
Because to make that page, it takes a lot of love and effort from the writer, the artist, the colorist, and the guy that does the type.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, you can have like six or seven people working on a comic. You can do the inks, the pencils, the letters, the shading, the colors, the flats. But yeah, it depends if you want to pay someone to do each of those functions. Yeah. You can.
And that's what I mean. Like, it really teaches you on just cut it down. This needs to matter. Every single panel needs to matter. And like, I think in terms of storytelling, that really helps a lot. So why didn't you not pursue the book then? Why didn't you not continue, edit, go back to it, and until I got to a place where you were happy with it?
It's just because I wasn't. I was actually, the more I read it, the worse it got. You know that whole thing about getting too close to your own work and sort of you start to see imperfections in it. And I think by that point, I was already sort of considering the comics. And I can't remember how me and Craig first got talking, but it was Craig that introduced me to a chap called Martin Connegan, who was running a comic anthology. And that's where my teddy bear story ended up in. So I met Craig before we even were working on art together. And then from after that came out, I was like, right, I'm going to try and do my own book, which was Bust One, which is like a post-apocalyptic road trip story. I did that with a friend from the old video game forums. He was a reader of my work in the past. I went onto the forum and said, hey, do I know any artists are any of the readers artists? I've got a project. And my mate Chris was like, hey, I can do art. And that's how we just decided to do it.
That's amazing.
It's such a random like happenstance, But that sort of speaks again to, like, you just do things and things will happen. You know, that whole mantra, like, it's
follow
just,
the flow.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit shameless. Like, I'll be honest, I'm always plugging my stuff and pitching people. And, you know, I couldn't tell you how many rejections across all my different hats that I've worn I've had. But you got to put yourself out there, man. It's like a lottery almost, right? You know?
So what was the most crushing one?
The most crushing one was probably, let me think. That's a good question. actually, I can tell you that. So I pitched the second series we did, Vessels, to a publisher in the States. And they actually initially expressed interest. They were like, oh, this sounds really cool. Can you tell us how the whole story arc goes from beginning to end? I won't spoil the end, of course, because it's still ongoing. But by the end, they just went, oh, so this was just, the whole story arc's just a dream and none of it mattered. And I went, no, that's definitely not what's happened. And I told them what actually was happening. And they went, yeah, we only like stories that actually where the events of the story matter and they're not just undone at the end. And I went, they're not all undone at the end. Please, like, give me this chance. And they were like, yeah, we're not interested. But they totally misunderstood. Like, and it's a very trippy comic and it's really weird. So I get why they didn't get it. But I was just like, But please give me a minute to explain. And they were like, nope, door closed. And I was like, oh, God. Oh, so that was a shame.
No, that was crushing.
But, you know, it's, you know, if they don't want it, someone else will want it. It's fine.
That's true. But not, like, hindsight, you know, it's great to say that now. But at the time, how did you feel?
Pretty gutted, yeah. Because it seemed like a sure thing. But that just taught me don't bank on anything as a sure thing until you know for sure. Because you're just going to set yourself up for disappointment, right? So yeah, never assume that things are working out until you know for certain.
Yeah. How long did it take you to pick yourself up again?
Not that long, to be honest, because I'm just so relentless. I never stop. So I was just like, okay, tomorrow's a new day. Let's keep on going, you know. And if a publisher doesn't want any of our books, you know, we crowdfund them anyway. They'll get made whether a publisher wants them or not. So yeah, it's just kind of pick yourself up. Keep on going.
Do you know what I noticed, right? In all of your work is the world building. You love world building, man. You are like it feels sometimes you make stuff just so that you can build a world. And like the story is important and everything, but for you it's all about the lore and like where, not even the backstories, because like from what I've seen, like the backstory, it's important. But like, I think you're in love with world building.
Yeah, that's true. So this may sound a bit cheesy, but I am always 100% convinced that no matter what story it is, if it's a film, whatever it is, a comic, the world should feel like another character. If the world doesn't have a lot of personality, you're probably not going to care what happens to it. Mm-hmm. And I got that from games. So like, if you think about some of the great game worlds that stood out to you, you've got City 17 from Half-Life 2, such a tangible world that just has this really like amazing, unique kind of vibe. Rapture from Bioshock. I mean, that is just like so much personality. It's so like iconic. You've got the Wastelands of Fallout, for example. Mm-hmm. Like it's where the world, like, you feel more invested in the story and what happens to the world because it speaks to you and you can relate to it and there's something appealing about that. So, yeah, when it comes to, like, world building, and you know, Dark Souls is my favorite trilogy of game ever, and that is so heavy on lore. It's probably come from that love of those games as well, but...
You haven't said The Witcher 3, man.
I only bought it, like, 2 days ago. I've never played it.
Right, guys, thank you very much for tuning in for this episode of Adventures in the Creative Industries. Thank you very much, Dave Cook, and bye.
I got it in the Black Friday sale.
Wow, did you get a Game of the Year edition?
Yeah, 13 quid.
Wow,
so good. Yeah, it's purely because I know it's a big open world game and my time is so limited, but now I'm like, hey, Christmas break's coming up.
Yeah, it took me 2 years to finish The Witcher 3.
Really?
Oh, and it's the only game I finished the DLCs as well. In terms of storytelling, it's incredible. You probably know all this stuff already, because you must have seen all the videos on YouTube and read all the reviews and stuff like that. But
I've reviews, yes, but I've tried to avoid the videos. It's interesting. Spoil it. Right. Well, because now I'm not a games journalist. When I was a games journalist, right, I had to know everything about the game before it came out. I had to keep up to date and write stories about all the trailers and all the story details that had leaked out. So it was kind of like spoiled before I got a chance to finish it, kind of thing, you know? But now I tend to avoid as many trailers as possible. But The Witcher 3, Craig from Killtopia has been banging on at me for like the best part of a year. Like, you need this game.
I don't need to do it then.
Yeah, you need. So I just went, you know what? I've got time now. I'm going to make time.
You're going to make time.
I'm going to just jump in.
Stop working.
Yes, yes, yes. I should take that.
Focus on gaming a little bit. Jesus Christ. Well, yeah, I mean, like, you probably like it because the world building is insane. But that's also because they were lucky enough to have, well, lucky enough. They were smart that they purchased the rights to a series of books which was full of lore and ideas and world building elements. So they just did a great job. CD Projekt Red is amazing anyway.
Well, we actually sent them a PDF copy of Killtopia for the staff, and they sent it around the staff, which is really cool. And we thought, hey, this is great. They're all going to like be tweeting out pictures of it and stuff, and no one did.
No one did.
But they did send it out, which was cool, like to all the staff and stuff. So they've all got free copies of it. And, you know, they've got Cyberpunk 2077, and we thought, there's a tie-in. We were just, like, again, being shameless, like, sort of hinting.
Try them all.
We can make a Cyberpunk comic for you to go along with the game, you know, hint, hint. Nope.
Cheers. Thank you very much. See you later. Bye. Well, you know, again, you got to be entrepreneurial, right? And put yourself out there and try them all and keep making things. But, like, okay, to go back to the world-building elements of your work, what's your favorite way of doing it?
Well, every comic idea that I've come up with has always started with a game experience that's just sort of hit me like, this is cool. This is like... And it's not like taking whole ideas wholesale, right? It's like thematic stuff. So it's like, Bust came from Fallout, essentially. So here's this terrible world that's gone through like the apocalypse. It's the world itself is on its knees pretty much. It's decayed beyond repair. But here's a small group of people trying to rebuild as best they can, while being hunted by raiders and mutants and stuff like that. And, you know, Fallout, everyone was living in vaults, and then they come out and they try to rebuild society. So I thought, that's a cool theme. And then we just sort of made it into like a post-apocalyptic road trip story around that. People going across America, trying to find like a place where they can live and thrive and rebuild. And then Dark Souls inspired Vessels, and then Japanese action video games inspired Killtopia. And I've got a fourth series in planning, which probably won't see the light of day for a while, but that's inspired by my love of like scrolling beat 'em ups, like Final Fight, stuff like that. And my favorite game of all time, Streets of Rage 2, which I love. It's my favorite
game
ever.
Can't believe you are so much into Streets of Rage 2, man.
Love it, man. I tried to beat the world record, legitimately.
Really?
The score record, yeah.
So where are you playing it? Are you playing on the MAME or you have the actual...
Oh, I've got two actual cartridges in case one of them breaks. I'm not joking.
Crazy. Which Mega Drive version are you using?
Mega Drive 2.
The 2. Oh,
it's my childhood console. Wow. It's the same one. Yeah.
That's amazing. Mine is at home in Italy somewhere.
I
hope mom did throw away.
Yeah.
Together with my NES and my Nintendo 64.
Oh, man, you got to get that stuff shipped over.
I will do. It was, for me, it was always like, I'm going to buy a house where I have a loft and then I can get all that stuff back. Now I do have a house with a loft. But getting that stuff delivered, not easy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'll deal with it. But do you know what? Like, this is like a bit of a silly question. I'm probably not going to help anything. But this love of video games... Right. I remember specifically when I was very young, one of my friends at school, he has his Amiga, you know, you put the little disc in it and it's like magic happens. And I remember being utterly like fascinated, captive almost. And like my parents couldn't afford an Amiga at the time, but we managed to get our hands on a Commodore 64, and that's what I played most of the time. And the Commodore 64 was hilarious because you can go to the newsagent and buy like a cassette with like 1,000 games on it. It was hilarious. But like, you know, I remember that process. It just started this thing with me, and I'm now 35 and I'm still pretty much a gamer. I'm playing Diablo 3 whenever I go a time on the Switch because it's just, you just pick up and play.
Yeah.
And I love indie games. I finished Cat Quest the other day. I don't know if you ever played Cat Quest.
No,
it's a silly game. Very simple. It's just very easy RPG. And then I was playing before then, I finished Hollow Knight. And anyway, I like playing games. And since then, it's always been the case. And I know that there are people that are not even bothered with video games. They don't care about it. So, like, I want to know from you, when was that moment that you thought, you know what? I love this.
There's two moments that stick out in my mind, actually, where I just, like you're saying, like, just blown away. And just, like, the medium just resonates with you, right? It's that moment. It's like almost like an epiphany where you're like, this is, I am so into this. I am a gamer kind of thing, right? For me, it was probably Christmas Day 1991 or, yeah, 1991 when I got my Mega Drive. Because I was used to the Spectrum, right, with the tapes that take forever to load or they could break, the graphics that were kind of not, I mean, for their time.
They were all in our heads.
You had to take like a leap of logic, you know, that little squiggle that's meant to be like a cat. You had to take a leap of logic and say, okay, that's okay, I get it. Sonic the Hedgehog 1. The leap in quality between like 128K games to 16-bit games. And I was like, this is like incredible.
Mind blowing.
It got to the point though where I was playing games all the time. I was quite a fat kid. I was like inactive. I was a gamer. All my friends were playing football. I was there playing Streets of Rage and Road Rash, and I didn't care.
I mean,
you know,
the Mega Drive was a beautiful machine. Yeah. I mean, like I had a break in between because I had an NES. So my parents managed to get their hands on an NES and I played Super Mario, Duck Hunt, you know, that version of the NES, the gun. And then I played a whole range of games. I don't even remember anymore. I played Zelda. I remember that Christmas. I played one of the hardest games ever, Ghostbusters. I think it was Ghostbusters 2. Yeah. Have you ever played that on the NES? Or not?
I've got it on NES. It's the one where the last level, you're the Statue of Liberty and you have to shoot all the ghosts. That is so difficult.
That one.
difficult.
That one was taxing. Yeah. But then, you know, video games then, they were a lot harder. Like playing Zelda, like it was just like you and a map you didn't have. I remember drawing the map on a piece of paper with my dad. It was amazing. We had such a great experience playing Zelda together.
It's like, okay, I'm in this world. Where do I go?
Yeah.
What do I do? Like, so cryptic.
It's so good. You just begin and you're like, da, 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 da.
But do you know how Miyamoto came up with the idea for Zelda? Do you know the origin story of it?
I don't think I do remember. I remember reading about this.
He went out into the woods as a kid. Just there was woods near where he stayed. I'm probably going to misquote this a little bit, but it was like he was just exploring in the woods one day, and came across a cave in the woods, and just like it was, he just went into it and he was like amazed at this like sense of wonder and adventure, and he was like, oh, what this is, and he felt like an explorer, and he wanted to capture that sense of wonder and exploration and adventure in a game. And then so many decades later, he made Zelda based on that one experience. And it's like, that's the feeling you get. You're like, where do I go? What do I do? I can go anywhere. You know, this is a grand adventure. And it was really cryptic though, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was incredibly cryptic. But that's the way video games were back then. So I like, we grew up with that. So like, that's why sometimes you see video games these days and they just take you by your hand. And it's like, yeah, now you need to do this.
Yeah.
Now you need to do that. And sometimes I enjoy that. But sometimes I just think back and they were good times, but video games right now, they are so much better.
Yeah.
Like, I am not one of those retro people. You know, I like to play an old game. I like to play a good indie game, but I just can't sit down and play any of the games. The only thing I'm playing is Bubble Bobble every once in a while, because I need to beat Ken Clark. Ken, if you're listening, I get you, man. So we did this thing, right, 2 years, 3 years ago. We had a mini NES in the studio when I was in Studio Something, formerly Something Something, and we were having a bubble challenge. Let's put it that way. It was harsh. Fierce. So Ken and I crop above everybody else. We are the best ones. And we kind of, bout after bout, you know, I was ahead, he was ahead, I was ahead, he was ahead. And then, 31st of December, 11:30, he sent a video to the group saying, oh, by the way, this. And he got the best score. And I had like 20 minutes to beat it. So dirty. So dirty. So, and that's what I'm playing. That's the only retro game I'm playing at the moment, every once in a while, just to try and beat that record. I get you, Kenji.
It's a good game, though, man.
Love it. Like, Bubble Bubble, still, it still holds that one.
Oh, it's great. It's the music. It's the music that always gets
yes.
me.
Yeah.
That's the one.
The podcast has been elevated right now.
Yes, we've reached God mode.
Yeah, we did. So, right, okay. So that the moment that you became a video gamer.
Yeah.
When was it?
The second one. So that was like the first moment I thought.
So
this
Sonic
is
the Hedgehog,
great.
First moment.
That hooked me in proper, yeah. Right?
Same. Finished the game. Loved
the
it.
The one where I thought this is incredible was Final Fantasy VII. Christmas Day 1997 or 8.
Oh, Christmas Day.
The
same magic.
Year my favorite album came out, Beastie Boys, Hello Nasty.
Oh, what
so
a
that
banger.
Was a
love
great
that record, man. Yeah. Love it. So good.
It's a good Christmas. It was seeing the opening FMV of the city and Cloud Strife jumping off the train. Then it just transitions into gameplay, and I'm like, this is the most realistic game I've ever seen. You look at it now and you think, oh, how primitive. But back then, man, we didn't know any better, right? So yeah. It was like, this just changed your mind of how cinematic a game can be. Like, it's just like a movie, you know, that then yeah. transitions into a game. And oh, man, like that's still my top three games of all time.
Really?
100%. Yeah, that for me was, because we were in high school, we mm-hmm. all got it for Christmas. If you didn't get that game for Christmas in my high school, you were a loser. So we all had it, and we were like, oh, where are you? You know, how did you do this bit? Oh, how did you get past this fight? You know, how leveled up are your characters? And we were talking about it for like
remember when you couldn't Google your way out, or you had to like ask your mates, how do I get past this bit? It's killing me.
Yeah, yeah. Or buy the strategy guide for a massive markup. They
the
were so expensive.
Strategy guide. That's why this, have you heard about Prima Guides that is going to shut down?
Oh, is it really? Yeah. Oh, that's a shame.
It's a shame.
But nice books. You know, they have like cool artwork and stuff.
Yeah,
so.
I bought The Witcher 3 one just because I liked to dig deeper in the game, but yeah. I actually never used it.
All right,
I used it like once just to see. You know, you have this like options if you pick this voice of dialogue or that voice of dialogue, the story changes, right? And I was like, I wonder what happens if you pick the other one. So I got the guy that started looking into it. Really, not that much changes. So I was like, yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's something changes, but it's okay. So I didn't really use it. But so those two moments, Sonic the Hedgehog and Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah, for sure.
So are you excited about the Final Fantasy VII remake?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's this weird thing, right, where a lot of people don't want it to happen because it's a bit like Alan Moore talking about Watchmen. He said when that was becoming a film that it was unfilmable. They shouldn't do it. It's never gonna work. And I actually didn't mind the film that much.
That's all right. It misses the point. But you know, it's
really
a standalone story. It's fine.
It was admirable how closely Zack Snyder recreated the panels.
Yes,
that was very the attention to detail was really impressive. But you're right. It totally missed the point.
It's not about the powers. It's about practically not having powers.
And that's like, I think, the problem of it being a film. And that's why I'm interested about the new series, because we'll have more time to dive into it. And so I hope the series captures that. But
who is doing the series? Is that him? Or?
Damon Lindhoff, who did Lost with J.J. Abrams.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I don't know. Like, I'm really compelled to see what it's like. But the same with Final Fantasy VII Remake. People thought this game, it can't be remade. It's too big. It's too influential.
Which is nonsense.
You'll miss the point. And the classic one, right? This is going to ruin my childhood.
Oh, God damn it.
You know, and you're like, dude, your memories of that game will not be tarnished by the new one. Don't even play the new one.
Exactly.
Besides,
you're 30.
Yeah. You know? Like, what is more important? But it's like... you know, I really want to see those iconic scenes that I remember from the original, the little blocky characters, but done full scale, like with the new engine and stuff. I think it's going to be cool. Yeah, I'm compelled to see it. I want to know what it looks like. You know, if it's good, it's good. If it's not, don't worry about it.
Yeah,
just go play the original.
Yeah. There's so many games out there. Just play something else, man.
Yeah,
there's plenty of time.
Never understood that whole "this is going to ruin my childhood" thing. Yeah. It's like, come on. Although I did see. There seems to be this big thing online right now, mm-hmm. and I don't know where it's come from, but loads of articles that say, oh, turns out, you know, people really, really want a remake of Back to the Future. There's loads of headlines in the last 2 days of this. And I'm like, where has this come from? Is this being fabricated by the studio to like try and canvas opinion?
100%.
And I'm like, but do you know that Robert Zemeckis, when he made the original, has a clause?
He swore to not make another one. And he has a clause in his contract.
It's in his contract. So it's not going to happen. They can't make it until he's dead.
So they're going to kill him? Is that what they're going to do?
Maybe.
Can we freeze the man? Because
Please never. Don't die, Robert Zemeckis. Please.
Please never. But do you know what? Like, sometimes it works, right? I mean, the new Ghostbusters was just, I think I'm fortunate the way they did it. And fair enough, it backfired massively. But like, if you remove all the bullshit and you just take the movie for what it is, I thought it was a weak movie. The story wasn't that good. The characters were like tropes. And like, it doesn't matter if it's female or male. If it's a bad story, it's a bad story.
Yeah.
And like, that was a shame. Because, I don't mind. If they're doing Back to the Future 3 and it makes sense and it's a good story, by all means.
Yeah.
Do you know? And like, but if you're making it just for money, meaning you're going to squeeze every single dime you can from it, so you're going to save money on the script, on the actors, on filming it. And like, what's the point?
Do you know, like, I think the biggest problem with that film was that Sony was at the helm of it. Like, their track record for movies recently, they put out so much garbage.
Like, I know, but Into the Spider-Verse looks so good.
That looks cool. I wonder if, because I saw a really interesting article actually about how, and this kind of applies to comics as well, how more often than not animated films, like we're talking like your Pixars and stuff, I mean, some of those films are so engaging and so emotional and so beautiful to look at. And I'm sure Spider-Verse looks amazing to look at as well, that cool stop frame animation stuff.
I see where you're going with this, yeah.
And they said the reason is storyboarding. When the camera's rolling thing, you know, you don't, but the process of making an animated feature is so meticulous. You need to pre-plan every shot, and because every shot must cost so much money to make, right?
We're back at that comic book.
Yeah.
And metaphor we were saying is like every single scene is worth so much money, it better make sense.
Exactly that. But then that's why I wonder, like, because I read some articles about the Ghostbusters film where all the actors were very good ad-libbers, right?
Yes.
So improvisation. Yes. But apparently they didn't really storyboard much, from what I understand. And from interviews, I saw a YouTube video sort of breaking down, you know, very balanced video, you know, just saying, here's maybe why it didn't work. It's because Sony just let these improv comedians improv, and then they kept the best bits. There was no actual script direction or consideration about, okay, what's funny. They just let the actors riff, but really you need more. I think you need more direction. And Sony, of course, cuts their films to bits as well. And it's a shame if you got someone like a James Gunn type, someone who gets ensemble comedies that are kind of cool and kind of funny, and then it might work. I'm interested to see how Ghostbusters might have turned out under someone else, because I don't think Sony was right for it. But you know,
do you know? I think I agree with you. Like the problem. You watch the new block Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Like there are some scenes you can totally see that they're just ad-libbing off each other. They're like just there to have a laugh, which sometimes it works.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that Bill Murray and the guys had a laugh on set and they did ad-lib some of the stuff. But also, I think the lack of structure was evident from what's happening in the movie. And also, you're right, it's being edited to death.
Yeah.
And the negative press before even launched, I'm sure they were scrambling to put stuff in and put stuff out. And
because I don't doubt for a second that the cast were fans of the original.
Absolutely.
Like they're of an age where they must have grown up with it, right? So I feel kind of bad for them as well. They probably wanted to honor the original, right?
And
I get the creative team, because Bill Murray and that, they did actually improv a few bits.
Yeah.
You know? Maybe they wanted to recapture that magic, which is a nice idea, but it's a shame, man.
It was treated too much like an SNL sketch sometimes,
a good analogy.
And it was a shame because I thought the potential was there, because the comedians, they're all great, they're all fun, and together I was like, this could actually be fun. It was a mediocre movie, and because it was Ghostbusters, it kind of ruined it for everybody. But I have felt so sorry for every single person involved in that movie. Because imagine the amount of hours and work and like people that worked late days, late nights. Like, the amount of effort that goes into stuff like that, and people stand up and being dickheads, it's just, I don't know.
I think a lot of people who were, you know, online being angry, like, they should be so embarrassed of themselves. Come on, man. Like, and it goes back to what we're saying. Oh, this film's going to ruin my childhood. It's like, dude, come on. Like, just, really?
Why? Just watch the old ones.
Yeah,
it's fine.
I don't get it, man. And, like, but then Sony never seems to learn, right? Because they did Venom, which I actually personally enjoyed because it was so hokey and so ridiculously crap in parts.
I didn't even try watching
it. But there was probably a decent film in there. Because again, apparently they chopped about 40 minutes worth of good footage. I mean, that could just be damage limitation.
But
the extras for the Ultimate Edition Blu-ray whenever it comes out.
But then, like, what's the name of the main actor?
Tom Hardy.
What's he in for Tom Hardy to come out and say they actually chopped the best bits out?
Exactly.
It's like for him to come and say, I remember some other stuff that's not there, and it's a shame because it was the best bits. And then you hear that, and you're like, Sony is doing it again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
It's like, fine, guys, it's okay. I won't just see it. I always if I'm not into something, I just not watch it.
Yeah,
I'll decide with my statement with my wallet, and I'll say, I'm not going. I'm not giving you the money. That's fine. I'll watch something. There's so much stuff to watch. You know.
Yeah, and you know, it's like, I don't know. It's a shame though, because I really want to see Venom and Spider-Man team up in the Marvel universe, but that's probably not going to happen now because of this. But you never.
Well, also, like, we lost
Stanley.
Yeah,
that's a big one.
That's a big one, and it's very a very influential figure in the industry. But we also lost Gunn, didn't we?
Yeah.
He's gone. He's not doing the thing anymore.
Yeah, apparently DC have hooked him up.
Finally, because the DC movies are horrendous. So.
Oh, we could get into that for a long time.
Oh, man.
I'm not actually much of a Marvel and DC reader, largely because I'm not too fond of superheroes, actually. There's a few that I enjoy.
You're not too fond of?
Superheroes. There's a few that I enjoy, but I like my favorite comic publisher is Image.
Right,
so
okay.
You're more, just more interesting worlds and stuff, right? I mean, I don't know if you've read much Image stuff, but their, you know, catalog of books are so varied. Really interesting ideas. And most of the characters aren't superheroes either. They don't have powers and stuff, mm-hmm. and a bit more grounded, you know?
Yeah.
Character pieces. Like, what have you got? I mean, you've got Lo, which is like one of probably my favorite modern comic series ever, which is about, you know, the ozone layer is gone. Everything above sea level is radioactive because of the sun rays coming down. So humanity lives in cities under the sea. But oxygen is running out and they're trying to find a new planet in space to live on. One day they find one and it becomes this big, like, civil war to be the first colony to go up there and mm-hmm. claim the planet. And it's all about, you know, it's set over decades and it's about this family bloodline going through these decades and the characters are great and it's very Game of Thrones and that people can get killed off instantly that you've built up, you know, this like fondness for, and it's just great. And there's not a superhero or superpower in sight.
You have heroes, but you don't have superheroes.
Yeah, they're flawed people, they're family members, you know, they've all got their demons, and it's just like, I love stuff like that. Mm. Character pieces, and the world is so tangible as well, you know, the world building is great.
Back to that.
Yeah.
It feels, that's probably why the new Batmans were so good, because Nolan just give the character a little bit more depth. I mean, it's still Batman and it's still lots of tropes in there, but like at the end of the day, I think he made an effort into humanize the character a lot more, and I appreciated that. That's why I enjoyed us. I mean, like, I'm a big superhero guy, so I grew up reading X-Men and Spider-Man, and like, it was a shame once I saw the X-Men movies that none one of it like kind of grasp the fact that the X-Men are a little bit daft and it's a bit fun, it's not gritty or anything. And I think that's why the Marvel universe, this whole new wave of movies made sense and people liked them, because they were like a bit daft, you know, they're a bit like, let's have fun. And like Thor Ragnarok was absolutely, that was a comedy, and I enjoyed it. Like, that was probably one of the best Marvel ones I've seen. And like, I'm getting very tired now of the whole universe. And
oh really?
Yeah. Too much. I mean, and the first few I was like blown away. There's a great, and but now it's too much stuff. But the Thor Ragnarok is an absolute blast. It's fun. Everybody should watch it. It's just like switch your brain off for a couple of hours and enjoy the ride, because it's a crazy ride.
Totally.
And the visuals, the art direction of that movie, man.
It looks like a power metal album cover.
Yes, yes.
Hulk fighting this giant wolf, and there's like knights with like riding on Pegasus and stuff.
And like then you've got like the city in the background is made on neons, yeah, and yeah, it's all like pink and green, and it's like, what is going on here?
It felt like a comic book.
It like, is like, exactly proper, like, you know, a comic book, and I loved it. I thought that was good fun. It's like, I think my theory is like, at the, if you remove everything from it, like, it's all about the storytelling aspects of the piece. Whatever movie you're watching, whatever, it's like, if you know what you're doing with the stories, and there are so many good storytellers out there, and like, you can tell. You start watching a movie and you're in it.
Yeah.
No matter what the movie is. Like, and we went to see A Star is Born, right? What was that, a month ago when it came out or something?
Yeah, yeah.
And we were so into it. Have you watched it?
No, I've had it recommended a lot, yeah, though. I missed it, though.
It is like, it doesn't matter what kind of movie it is. It's a good story. And they told it very well.
Yeah.
That's all that is. Like, I don't understand people saying, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do this or that. Just try it out, man. It's fine. It's a good story. That's all it is.
I had that with La La Land.
Yes.
I really wanted to see it. I'm a big fan of Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling. I think they're brilliant. It was a musical, right? And yeah, I'd never seen a musical in the cinema, right? I'd never, but I went with my wife and watched it, and I thought, this is brilliant. Yeah. And I think it's maybe because it wasn't all songs and all, you know, one song into the next. Yeah. There was big gaps. There's not that many songs in it, actually, where people sing, but loved it. Thought it was really well done and it was great. And all my mates were like, why did you go see that? It's a musical. I'm like, why not?
Yeah.
Like you're just saying, yeah, if it's a good not? Film, it's a good film. It's like,
lads,
you know, it's,
just get it together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Go watch it. And then go watch A Star is Born. It's good. It's not going to kill you. You're not going to lose your masculinity. It's fine. It's good fun.
And do you know what? It just speaks to, like, again, trying things. You never know what you're going to like.
Absolutely.
Just give things a shot, right? That's it. Leave your baggage and your presumptions at home, kind of thing, you know?
Yes, exactly. That's all there is to it. I mean, I totally agree with that. Like, well, we're just like agreeing to each other now. This is not going to do any well for the podcast.
It's synergy, man. It's
good. Synergy. Yes, we're on the same line. But like, you know, one thing. Let me see my notes. I forgot something that you haven't talked about. One thing I struggle with, and I would like to hear your thoughts on this. It's praises, because Killtopia is doing really well now. How do you feel about it? How do you deal with praises?
It's difficult. I still haven't figured it out yet. Because, you know, like, I don't know where it's come from. I really don't. But I quite a self-deprecating guy. And I think a lot of us are, right? And it's not that it's not like I read the book and think, oh, this is terrible now. I've gone off of it. It's more just like, I firmly believe that no one will ever know it all or never be the best at something, right? You always have space to grow. You shouldn't have as much of an ego that you think, oh, there's nothing else you can teach me. I'm amazing at this. You know, I don't need your advice. Or, I just think you always have a chance to grow. You always have a chance to improve. You never know what's going to influence you next. And I think if you think, right, I'm at my A game, there's nothing else anyone can teach me, you're just closing yourself off from all these other inspirations and things. And so I guess it's not, when people praise the book, I'm like, cool, yeah, thank you so much. But in my mind, I'm like, I've got more work to do. I can be better. Like, not to be harsh on myself, but just, right, cool, what's next? How do we improve on this? Maybe that's a bit of a obsessive way of looking at it, maybe, or maybe like, maybe I'm making too much more work for myself. It's probably true. But I'm always like, cool, we've done a good job. People like it. What's next? How do we grow from here? I never kind of rest. You know what I mean? Like, because... I guess you can get to a point, some people get to a point where they're like, yeah, I know I'm good. I don't like that. I don't like that attitude, you know.
Do you know what? I don't think I've ever met anybody, especially here in Scotland, that has that attitude.
Oh, like, right. It's good, yeah. Like, well, we're quite a self-deprecating nation.
Yes. I mean, like, here's the thing here that you kind of, you don't want to shoot people down, but there's a lot of people that are quite negative and they have like kind of a negative outlook, which is, it doesn't help, because having a positive outlook is what helps.
Yeah.
Is what help you in achieving whatever you want to achieve. But it feels that I personally struggle with praises, and it's because the way I grew up and the way praises were done in my family and stuff like that. So I'm wondering if, is that always been the case?
I think so. I do think so. So like, when someone's, it's weird, like I'm, and it's not to say I'm not grateful for the praise, like it's recently, it has been so incredible, like actually for the amount of feedback we're getting about the book, right? And the award win and people and the publishing deal, and we're hearing from people I've never met. I'm getting messages online from people I've never met who have bought the book from the online shop, from the publisher. You know, I didn't sell it to them direct. And they're messaging us and saying, oh, I really like the book, man. You know, when's the next one coming out? This is great. And it legitimately blows my mind. Like, I say that, one of the things I say a lot online is, hey, we got a new review. It's really positive. This is blowing my mind. I'm not like saying that. Like, I'm literally sitting there like, this is nuts. What does this mean? Like, what does it mean that this thing is popular and people like it? To go from like really chasing praise and success and trying to, well, maybe not chasing praise, but trying to just chase that success, you know, yeah, pitching to publishers. And now we've got something that people genuinely like. It's quite a foreign feeling. It really is. We don't actually need to work as hard because people just naturally seem to like it. Like, I've sold copies of Killtopia based on like a single sentence before at comic cons. They're like, cool, yeah. Whereas the other books I had to really hustle and pitch. And so it's resonating with people in a way that I didn't anticipate, and it's a weird feeling, but I'm just trying to roll with it.
So looking at this, right, and looking at the way you guys got it published and everything, I know that you're a marketer, and like, it's funny to say that your real job, you're an SEO expert, you're a copywriter, so it's like so really you kind of, you know how it works, right? And to me, Killtopia, it gave me that vibe that the actual book, that is the marketing. Like, you guys together, or yourself, and you crafted that as an advertising brief. Is that, am I wrong saying that?
Yeah, do you know, like, that's, I've never had it described that way, but that does make a lot of sense to me in retrospect, because like, we, you know, every book we do is like something that we're passionate about. Like, it always starts as something we would want to read that doesn't exist yet.
Yeah.
Because like you said earlier, you know, if you're just making stuff to make sales and to get a publishing deal and get popular, you're pandering to that, what you think people want.
Yeah.
Whereas with this, like, I'd never done this before, right? We actually documented a marketing strategy in a Word doc. We actually started to write down, right, okay, this is a cyberpunk book. Here's all of our influences from like cyberpunk films to writing to artists to video games. Okay, what is it about all these things that people like, that we also like? Because everything we did was like us speaking as fanboys, basically. And looking at that, we're like, how do we market it? What do we make to get those people interested? You know, like extra rewards for the Kickstarter. So for example, for the Kickstarter, we were giving away packs of postcards, but it was Killtopia art as video game boxes.
Yeah.
So it's like a Mega Drive box, awesome, a Mega CD. Yeah. And people love that because they're also gamers. So yeah. It's weird. Our Facebook page, because of that, has become not just about the comic. It's weird. Like, we also post up news from the anime world and the manga world and cyberpunk. So we posted up a piece recently that Otomo, who wrote Akira, is working on his next full-length book series. And that's huge, you know, if you're into that.
Everyone is dying to read.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's the guy, right?
Like, he's the cyberpunk guy.
So we put up just a news piece, nothing about promoting us, just, hey, like, you know, we're really excited to see this. Like, what do you guys all think about it? So much engagement, so much conversation. These are people who really care about the genre that we are also passionate about. And I think, marketing aside, if you're that sincere about what you love, and you don't like BS people about it, you're genuine, that, I think, was one of the biggest marketing things for us. People could see that we were fans of the thing we were creating.
Yeah.
And the inspirations, and that helped a lot. We're just like them, you know, we want to read this kind of story.
What I thought was really smart. It was saying, we are good at this, so we are aware of our strengths. This is what we want it to look like. This is what we want to say. and this is what we like, but also what a big audience like, this is going to work. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's adding that understanding prior to make a project.
And that's the thing, right? Because I often get messed, because I wrote a few how to do a Kickstarter guides on our site. And a lot of people have read them and said that they liked them. They got in touch and said, oh, this really, was really helpful. One of the things I get a lot is people who are midway through their Kickstarter saying, my Kickstarter is not going to make it. What can I do to fix this? And I give as much advice as I can, but I'm quite honest with them and say, if you're only thinking about this halfway through, how do I make my Kickstarter a success halfway through? It's already too late. And that's not me being harsh about it. It's just from experience. You know, people need to know that it's coming well in advance so they can prepare for it. They know, they get the gist, they understand what you're all about, they know who you are. Because Kickstarter is also about the person behind the project. You're not just investing in the end product. Because it's a vote of trust. You're investing in something that may never come out, or the final product might be not as good as the promises that they were making in the pitch. So you also need to like trust the person behind the project and understand what they're about and get their sincerity, right? But a lot of people come up to me and they're like, oh, my Kickstarter's not doing that well, or we're launching a Kickstarter tomorrow. What can we do to build up hype about it? And I'm like, you need to do that before it goes live, because you can't just, you know, people need to know it's coming. You can't just start marketing something that's already live, I don't think.
Your Kickstarter was set to $4,000.
Yep.
And $4,000 was for you guys to break even and be able to pay your taxes, pay Kickstarter, and make the comic book.
Yep.
And you hit 16K. How did you feel about that?
Oh, it was wild. Because, like, I've said this before, but I think it bears repeating, right? Because this is just indicative that you never know what's going to happen, right? So the night before, it was a Thursday night, we had the butterflies in the stomach. We were like, oh, no, tomorrow we go live. This is it. You know, what happens next? You know, you never know. So we were like, okay, we've been looking at this campaign page for months, fine-tuning it, getting everything right. However, we still don't know if it's going to get funded. So we were like, okay, we had a serious conversation about what happens if we don't make our target. Do we just self-fund it and it would take a long time to come out if we did that? Or do we do we pitch it to like Creative Scotland or someone like that, right? You know, for investment. And we thought, right, let's just see what happens. And then it went live at noon on the Friday, 9 a.m. on the Saturday. I looked and it was like well over its target. And I was like, what is going on? This is crazy. And then my phone, all my alerts, you know, from every time we got a new backer, my phone was just vibrating the whole of that month. Just like, oh my God, what is going on? But then we started to think like, what does this mean? Like, cause what is this signifying? Does this mean it's going to be a big hit? Or is it just like we hit it at the right time? Or what is it? Cause we didn't know what it was about it that people were liking. We later figured out it was a lot of cyberpunk people. People got this sort of manga vibe. I mean, the cover is like basically a take on Akira, right? Yeah. So people resonated well with that. But at the time, we were just like, what is going on? Then we started to think about stretch goals, and we started getting in touch with like people who have worked on Marvel and DC and Dark Horse. And we got some really big names to do like bonus prints for us. The artist behind my all-time favorite comic series, Transmetropolitan, was our top tier stretch goal. I just got his email from a friend and emailed him. His name's Derek Robertson. He's done like tons of stuff. I got in touch with him and said, your comic series is the first comic I ever read and the first I ever read where I felt I like comics now. Remember we were talking about the watershed gaming moments? Well, Transmetropolitan for me was the watershed comic moment where I thought, yeah, I like comics now. Because I was a journalism student at Napier. This comic was about journalism and it just spoke to me at the time. And I went to him and said, hey, you're like the guy. Your comic series got me into comics. I probably wouldn't be doing this right now if it wasn't because of you in part. Do you want to do a print for us? We'll pay you, obviously. And he went, yeah, sure. And I got that email back, and I'm not ashamed to admit this. I was almost like a little bit choked up. I was like, this is nuts. This guy is like a god to me and he wants to do this. I think that was one of the moments where we thought, right, if he wants to get involved, I think we've hit on something here. We still don't know what it means, and it's still a bit terrifying and exciting, but do you know, it's just going from $4,000 to $16,000 just changes everything.
So did you shed a couple of tears?
I was close to it, honestly. And I'm, you know, I don't cry at movies. I'm it's just because I know their films, right? That's, you know, I sort of detached myself from it. But in that one moment, I was like, oh my God, like this is, I was sitting there stunned on the couch, just like, this is nuts. It's weird, man. You know, I don't know. But yeah, it's a weird feeling.
It's like you don't cry at movies, but you do cry at achievements, though.
Yeah, it's a weird one, right? I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes at the moment that I can't really talk about. Like, we were pitching the comic around to, like, places and stuff, right? I can say that much, but to see what happens. But it's just the fact we're getting feet in the door now, these doors now, yeah. And it's just like, this is insane. I don't know where this path's going to lead or where the series is going to end up, but it's exciting. All my friends say, don't worry about it so much. Just roll with it. And be happy that things have happened. Yeah. It's what you said about praise earlier. I'm not good with praise either. Like I'm like, oh hey, thanks, cool. We're nobody's. We're not anymore, really. That's the thing, and that's the weird thing we can't get used to. That people want to see our stuff. There's people talking to us about doing guest slots at comic cons where you're like a special guest and stuff, and that's just mind blowing. Because when we started doing cons, we were like on this tiny little table.
Tiny little table like with cells, a couple of things. Looking,
yeah, with like one book.
the wooden table from B&Q that you just sold for it out.
But now it's like, oh yeah, we can maybe get you down as a guest and stuff. And it's like, this is nuts. Like so New York Comic Con, you kind of have to get, like, it's really hard to get in there. It's all curated. Mm. But I got in touch with them and said, hey, when do your applications open? We've never done it before. Like, we don't even know if we're a good enough level to do it. Here's my comic. And they basically invited us to apply for next year. And that blows my mind because that is like
That's awesome. One
of the biggest ones in the world.
It's like a recognition. They see your comic. They see it's good. You see the good vibes you're getting from it. And it's like, for them, you're an up-and-coming author, you know?
And that's the weirdest thing.
Yeah, it's never like, mind that you've been doing this for almost a decade. It's like, oh no, you're up and coming.
Yeah, it's weird, man. Like, I'll never get used to it. And that's not me like being a humble brag. I hate humble bragging, but personally, but genuine, just like, this is nuts. What are we even doing here? How did we get to this place? What does it mean? Like, it's crazy, man.
It's good though. Yeah. Like, I love when I see this happening. When I see people that like, they're really hustling for all their life, and then all of a sudden they just pop. It goes like,
yeah.
And that's it. It's fun and games. We had this theory with Jordan from Studio Something. We were talking about it years ago, and we're like, you know what? You just keep doing stuff in your life, right? You try this, you try that, and you work hard until you get to a point that something is gonna pop. If you keep trying, one day something is going to pop, and that is going to open the doors to years of work that you've been doing in the background and people didn't know about you. It's all out there, and like, once that thing pop, everything else will follow, because it just all show that you've been active and you've done loads of stuff. And that's your case, that you are the embodiment of that. You're like, you've been doing this for so long, you've been trying for so long, and here's your moment. Enjoy it, man.
And it's crazy because like, I remember how it used to feel at the very start, thinking, so initially the first book we put out was a one-off, right? It actually ended. There was like room to continue if people wanted it, but we thought, we've done a book, we did a Kickstarter, that's it, we can say we've done it.
Yeah.
We took it to a Comic Con. I can't even remember it was Glasgow Comic Con, actually. It was the first one I ever did. And I shared a table with someone. I didn't even have my own.
Not even your own table.
No, totally. Because I had one book and I had like not many copies of it. But people bought it, and then folk were like, "Yeah, this is cool. You should. Are you doing when's the next one coming?"
Yeah.
And I went, next one.
What? I made this a miracle. I made this, mate.
And I was like, cool. Maybe this is a thing now. But I remember when I started to think, I'm going to try and make this a thing. Right. I started Card Shark Comics. I thought, I'm going to try and grow this. How difficult it felt, and how impossible the road to doing something, achieving something felt. The struggle, the late nights, the, you know, rejecting offers to hang out with people, and it takes its toll, man. I mean, you'll probably know yourself, man, from you know, working deadlines and stuff. It's a tough gig, man, and you can get lost in it, and it can beat you down. But in retrospect, you think, oh, it was worth it. But at the time, man, it's difficult. I'm not gonna lie, you know.
What was that? And the whole journey was the hardest moment you encountered?
I guess it was we actually had to delay two of our books by about half a year because the artists were working on multiple projects. They were getting kind of burned out. I was getting burned out. We eventually got the books out, and these were Kickstarter books as well. So mm-hmm. I had to constantly apologize to the backers. The strange thing is none of them cared. They were like, we can see you're making this. You're updating us every single day. Don't worry about it. We know we're going to get a comic. Yeah. So you need to start stressing.
They just seen Kindle this dinner there and they're like, oh, we're just waiting. They're going on with their lives. And then one day it comes through the mail. It's like, I bought that thing. Yeah,
exactly that. But then that was very difficult because I was stressing out. And I feel almost like if people buy my book, I feel duty bound to give it to them on time in the format they want, the highest quality possible. Some say I stress too much about that, but people have basically gambled on your project. Again, like I said, they don't know what the end result's going to be. That's like a trust thing. Like, you know, they've placed trust in you to deliver. I want to deliver. But man, like, we had to delay two books by about 6 months. We did them, and I haven't done the next chapters of those series since. So it's Busting Vessels. But they're coming back next year. I took some time out, started something new with Kiltopia, and now I feel ready to get back on it. So Bust 4 is in production now. Vessels 3 will start like early next year. So, but that almost made me contemplate giving up the whole thing.
Really?
Yeah, I was so burned out, man. Like, it wasn't cool. At the time, I didn't like my job that I was at. It wasn't in a good place, but I'm glad we stuck with it.
So how did you get to that burnout moment?
I think it was just as soon as the book went out. I mean, because it's just me, Cartrack Comics, right? That's my kind of pen name. It was putting out two books. You know, actually, we had the finished book. We had to then bag them up, mail them out, all that stuff. And because I was putting out two books roughly, because one got delayed, so it kind of, two books kind of came out the same month. I was sitting after work in my room, bagging up hundreds of comics, like an assembly line robotically.
That's when it hit you then.
For like about a month I was doing that, carrying, you know, taking to the post office as many comics as I could carry to mail them out. We hadn't allowed properly for the postage, so I was paying hundreds of my own money for it, and I was just like,
that's another hard lesson.
This isn't work. Yeah, all very hard. So if you're running a Kickstarter, over whatever you think you need to pay for postage, charge a little bit extra, even if it's a pound more, because you will need it. You never know. Anyway, yeah, and I just thought, this is like far too much. Like, I was sleeping 5 hours a night, less sometimes, than going to my work the next day.
Yeah, because you had a full-time gig at the time,
yeah. Yeah. So it was just like, is this worth it? My health is probably suffering now. I put on loads of weight. I wasn't sleeping. I was getting headaches all the time, and I was just like, this is not worth it. But the time out to do Kiltopia, so it's been a year and a bit since that happened. No, almost 2 years actually since that happened. We've recharged, we've actually figured out how to do it properly, and I think there was a big learning experience, but I think now we're ready to start those other series back up again.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of excited. We're all the teams are like, it feels quite good to get back on this horse again. I kind of missed this world and this story. And
So like, going forward, because I know that you also have your own name/business to carry on. You have your own contracts, you have your own work. So are you planning on becoming an author like full-time, or are you still going to have a job on the side?
It's an interesting one. It's because comic book writing, in some instances, it's kind of become a little bit like Spotify now, right? So what Spotify is to music. And what I mean by that is, so if you got a publishing deal, Or let's say you got invited to work on Deadpool for Marvel, for example, right? Mm-hmm. You get paid for those pages you do, and then you get like a percentage of every sale. From my understanding is, and it's quite a limited understanding because Marvel won't reveal how it does it, right? Yeah. But my understanding is you get like pennies on the pound per issue. Now, if it's a Deadpool comic and it sells 5 million copies,
You're fine.
But the comic book industry in the physical format is kind of in a bit of flux at the moment. Sales are down. I think a lot of the comic shops and retailers and publishers are now scratching their heads over how do we revitalize this and how do we survive? Yeah. So it's like, there's no guarantee you're going to make your millions. What has become more valuable than making the book is the IP rights.
Right.
And this is where people can make us. I mean, look at Kirkman, who did Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. I guarantee that he probably was doing pretty well for himself off the books, but once he sold that to the TV rights and the video game rights,
that's
where the big money came from, I think. So that's why you get a lot of people who, they're comic book writers, they maybe have one series out, but that's all they do. But in the background, they're writing pitches. They're making like the first 10 pages of a comic to pitch to Netflix and movie studios and publishers because they're trying to land that big IP sale. You know, if you get your script optioned for like movie rights, and do you know what an option is? Have you come across that before?
Is that an option where they offer you money? It's usually a very small amount, and that means that you can't sell that to anybody else. They kind of like they're leasing your IP until something happens, and if something happens, they'll pay you more money. Otherwise, the option just fades after a few years.
Yeah,
and I heard that's how it works. Like, there's a lot of people they can't do anything with their work because they optioned it too early, or they couldn't find anybody interested. They got an option, and then that's it. Died because they don't want to make it.
Yeah, and so this is it now. I think for, you know, we've had this whole discussion recently about what does it mean to make it, and you know, I did like a blog post on LinkedIn about like what does it mean to make it. You know, people say in comics, you know, I just want to make it. So, well, what does that mean? Tell me what that actually means. And for a lot of people, it's, I want to get my comic optioned. That is a good way to make a big chunk of money at one time. But to make a salary, you know, going back to your question, to make a salary off of comics, I think it's quite a hard thing to do. I think a small percentage of people do this. I mean, you always get people taking side gigs and commissions to top up their income. And it's a little bit, I think it's quite admirable actually to try and do it as a full, for people who do it full time, because it's quite brave, you know, because the money could dry up very quickly.
Yeah.
But you know, you get people who are doing comic books, but on the side they're doing commissions and they're doing art for brands, and it's a bit of a hustle, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's really admirable. It's not for everyone.
No.
But if the right thing came along, maybe. But then I'd be worried about comics being like less the hobby and more a job. And that's another reason why I left games journalism, was that I didn't want to play games anymore because it felt like too much like a job. And I thought, games are like my number one hobby and I'm hating it. Something's got to give. This isn't right. So I stopped making games my job, made them my hobby again. So
that's,
I don't know.
You know what? That is a very interesting topic. It's a shame that this is the end of the podcast. But it's something... I'm really struggling myself with. I'm struggling not with it. I'm struggling with the thought of understanding what is passion and what is work and where the line is. Something I still haven't worked out yet. So I can definitely have you again, and we could talk about. We could start talking about that, like I'll take a therapy session. We'll continue from where we ended. Well, Dave, thank you very much, man. I really appreciated you being here. This was a great chat, and. Finally, I got somebody I can talk video games with, and shamelessly put it on the podcast. That said, thank you very much for being here. I wish you all the best in the world, and I'm sure you are going to crush it because you put the work, and you know it's going to be a slow process, but you're already there, man. You're already far ahead where you were a year ago. Think about next year. I'm so excited to see what you're going to do in the next 2 to 3 years, because you got so much good stuff out there now. You're getting the people are starting to realizing how good your stuff is, and who knows? Do you know what I mean? I'm excited. Who knows what the fuck is going to happen? Maybe Killtopia will become a TV show at one point. Who knows?
Oh, don't, man. Honestly, it's weird. It's something I should be looking forward to. Like, yeah, but if there was a word that could describe being terrified and excited at the same time, I don't know what that word is, but that's how it feels sometimes, because it's mind-blowing. It's big, right? It's too bigger than anything you've done before, kind of thing. And it's like, I don't know.
I think the best thing you can do, get your head down, keep working.
Yeah.
This is what I do all the time. And if one day something I do will get that kind of recognition and it will get people interested, I think the best thing I will do is probably get my head down and keep working until I can't work anymore.
Yeah.
Until my wife comes and says, hey, switch the computer off, you know? So, well, Dave, lovely, man. Thank you very much for coming. And hopefully I'll have you again, because now we got all the, you know, we got the introduction out of the way, we can talk about video games for an hour and a half, you know.
I would love to do that.
My idea is one day soon I want to do another podcast, and all it is video games in Scotland. So because we got so many people working in the industry here, yeah. And I don't know if you're aware, but Epic Studio just opened a new office in Edinburgh.
I did not know that. That's yes, cool.
They've been around for a year, and now they're officially out there. They're lovely. They're absolutely lovely. And we have Rockstar, and we got Epic, mm-hmm. two massive ones, and we got plenty of smaller studios. Why are we not talking about video games in Scotland? God damn.
Yeah. Totally, that'd be cool. Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to get involved?
I'm gonna set it up, man.
I'm not kidding. I'm gonna set this up.
Yeah, yeah. Do it.
Right, fine.
Do it.
Right. Thank you very much for listening again. I just want to thank everybody. Blown away by the amount of people that are giving me feedback. Are listening to this podcast. I am really grateful. Thank you very much, people. Have a good rest of the day. Bye.
Right. That's class, man.